Thank you. Thank you. It's so good to be here, and thank you for asking me to come along to talk about theology and music, which sounds scary, I know, but I don't think it is too scary. I think it should be a really great time for us this morning, and what we're going to be doing is really just dipping our toes into what is a big, big subject, but think of it as an introduction to theology and music, or music and theology. And to get us started, I thought I would do a short kind of reflection or meditation using some music, just to get us into a kind of nice zone at this time in the morning. So here we go. The first piece of music has a violin and piano, and I'll just play that to you. The violin is very subtle, actually. You'll hear the piano mostly, but there's a violin running with the piano. What I'd like us to do is to think of the piano as representing God, and the violin representing us, each of us. God was always there. In the beginning, as we know from the Bible, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then when we look at Psalm 139, we remember that it says, for you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. And in the next piece of music, the next section from the same piece of music, we have this sense that God is there in times of plenty and times of ease, maybe carefree times, halcyon days. God is under us and God is over us. Remember that we're picturing here God as being represented by the piano and each of us by the violin. And God is also there not just in the good times, but he's there in the rush of life, in all the busyness, when life is too frantic maybe or exciting for us to be bothered with God. God is still there. God doesn't change, and yet, as it says in Hebrews, is able to sympathize with our weaknesses. And if we're tempted ever, God has been tempted in every way, just as we are. And then when difficult times come, he will be there too. He's been there with the saints down the ages, as they have testified. But there are times when we can't see God, perhaps, for the pain that we experience. But God is there. And when we experience anguish or pain or anger, God is there suffering. And remember that Jesus wept at the tomb of his friend Lazarus.
Thank you.
after the storm, we're not left on our own. But at the same time, God doesn't force himself on us as we try to come to terms with what has gone before. He can help, he can transform our unbelief if we ask. If we say to him, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. But he doesn't force himself. So that was a piece of music by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, and who's still alive, in fact. And it's a piece which is written originally for violin and piano, but it's sometimes played by viola and piano. I think I've heard a version by cello, arranged for cello and piano. It seems to work for all those different stringed instruments. And my interpretation of that, it's not my guiding interpretation of it, but it's something that I've used sometimes at church and in different contexts, the idea of the piano, which seems to be so constant through that piece of music and essentially playing the same kind of thing all the way through, when the violin weaves its way, if it is a violin, weaves around it, and the violin is the thing that has the variation, I thought to myself, well, that piano could represent the constancy of God in all the changes and the things that come at us in life. But as far as I know, Arvo Pärt has never thought of it like that. That's entirely my interpretation. And one of the main things that you discover about music when you start trying to think about what music might mean, whether or not you're thinking of it theologically or not, actually, is that it's very hard to say that any piece of music means anything at all, which perhaps comes as a surprise to you, I don't know. Music basically finds it very hard to talk about things very specifically, to say definitely, this is what I'm talking about. Music tends to actually talk about itself, pretty much. I'm talking mostly about instrumental music. Once you get song or pictures, and pictures are the thing that I'm particularly interested in with music, but that's not what we're looking at primarily today, because we don't have a screen. But once you get words with music, of course, you've got something to direct you and maybe make you think about what the music means. But if you've just got purely instrumental music, very hard to know what the music is saying outside of itself. Does anybody have in mind a particular piece of music which is definitely about something? Just shout it out to me. The Four Seasons, yes. Vivaldi's Four Seasons, that's a well-known one. Yes, the Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima. That's right. And one more? The Pastoral Symphony, yes. Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral Symphony. Now, it's true that we do associate those pieces of music with those things. Could be mainly because that's what they're called. It could be mainly that, I think some of them, it is closer. Something like the Pastoral Symphony, you get the cuckoo sound. So I think people would begin to pick up on something perhaps to do with, I don't know, rural life or the countryside. You might get that from listening to it if you didn't know that's what it's called. But the interesting thing is that I think it's actually very, very rare that a piece of music does that. Usually a piece of music doesn't tell you what it's about specifically in terms of an idea. So a piece of music doesn't say to you, the cat sat on the mat, or Mary had a little lamb. It just can't do that. I find this interesting. Sometimes I play a piece of music to people and I ask them to say what they think it's evoking. This would be an example. I'll play you this piece of music and let's see what we think it evokes. You might know it, of course. Here we go. That's enough of that one. So if you don't know what that piece is, who recognises that piece? A few people do, yes. I'll tell you what it is in a moment. But if you, those of you who don't recognise it, does anybody have a feeling as to what it might represent? If it, does it say anything to you? Explore, very specific, exploring an underground cavern when there's a feeling of ill ease. And somebody said goblins. Any others? I like these. Emotion of fear. Fear, yes. Yes, fear is good. Sorry, over there. Discontent and argument. So none of these things are actually good. I think we're all sensing something which makes us feel uneasy in some way. And that, and it is an emotion that we're sensing, perhaps, an emotion of fear. It's actually the prologue to Hitchcock's film Vertigo. So there we are. So in some ways, you're very close, aren't you? Because the idea, Bernard Herrmann, fantastic film composer, is trying to create a sense of, well, the main character, played by Jimmy Stewart, suffers from vertigo, and it's all about the kind of the sickening feeling that he experiences when he looks down out of a building, and he begins to kind of feel giddy when he does that. So I think it comes over very well. But I don't think, nobody said vertigo. There we are. So here's another one. This is a bit of a trap, actually. I wonder what you think this might represent. And you might, some of you might represent, this is one of mine, so be kind about it, please. That's it. Short and sweet. It's a shame I only get paid by the second. Did anybody recognise that? Yes, one or two, yes. So if you don't recognise that, and you don't know what it is, which is most of you, which is a pity, but there we are. Anybody, what do you think that might represent or be for?
Celtic culture.
Celtic culture, sir. The opening up of a vast vista. I like that. I like that, yes. Any other guesses? Sorry?
A desert scene.
A desert scene. And one more.
And then there was light.
And then there was light. It's very, very big. We're thinking big here. I like. In a sense, they're all right, because that was the opening to a Radio 4 series called The History of the World in 100 Objects. And I had to write 600 pieces of music for that series, and that was one of the ones which was at the beginning of each program. And the brief for that piece of music, believe it or not, was that it would have to represent any place in the world at any time in human history. So you were all bang on, actually. Thing about program music, one of the terms for music which is very explicit in telling us what it is trying to say, program music, is that actually primarily it has to be good music. I think the reason that we still listen to Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony is because it's a beautiful, sublime piece of music. And if it was rubbish music, you know, we wouldn't listen to it and think, well, I'm going to listen because it's a pastoral symphony. We listen primarily because it's good music. And I think Four Seasons goes up and down in popularity, but I think its enduring popularity is that it's pretty good, actually, and it can be done very well. It can be a very exciting piece of music, depending on who does it. But music's difficulty in speaking about precise things has made many people, maybe it's what's made people suspicious of it, over the years, particularly in the church, actually, in the history of the church has had a very ambivalent relationship with music. And I think that's because we all know that music moves us. It creates powerful emotions within us. But what's it talking about? It's incredibly transient. It's here and then it's just gone. Where is the last piece of music we listened to? Where is the music now that we just heard for the history of the world in 100 objects? Where has it gone? It was there and now it's gone. It's very transient. And I think perhaps that accounts for something of the suspicion that has been, you know, found when it comes to music over the centuries in the church, that transience and, as I say, its inability to talk about things specifically, its massive emotional power. Also, it could be partly why music can be one of the most divisive things in church life, because it moves us all emotionally and it triggers memory for us. Emotion and memory can go together very powerfully. And I think one of the reasons why some of the older folk at my church, not all of them by any means, will come up to me and say, "We want more older hymns, please," is because they associate those older hymns perhaps when they were younger, or something important was happening for them. So music, very powerful, very transient though. Music was the thing that always moved me most. You know, it was the only thing I could do when I was at school. I was rubbish at everything except music, it seemed. And it was just the thing that I loved more than anything in the world. And I was interested to find various sayings or aphorisms about music. This is one by Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer, great intellect. He said, "My heart, which is so full to overflowing, has often been solaced and refreshed by music when sick and weary." And the painter Stokowski said, "A painter paints pictures on canvas, but musicians paint their pictures on silence." Herbie Hancock, the jazz fusion pianist, said, "Music happens to be an art form that transcends language." Van Morrison said, apparently, "Music is spiritual, the music business is not." Bono has said that music can change the world because it can change people. That's a big claim, actually. Now, I've said that music finds it hard to represent things specifically, but what we're here to do this morning is just to think a little bit theologically. So we're going to dip our toes into some ways in which looking at music can maybe help us think a bit more theologically, think about God, or maybe just perceive something about God that we hadn't perceived before. One of the big areas which people have looked at, and one of the things which is key to music, fundamental to music, maybe the thing, is the idea of tension and resolution. Tension and resolution. Music is a form where forms of stress are set up which have to be resolved. We want them in some way to be resolved, and that tends to be what happens in, now when I say in all music, I'm talking about tonal music. Always lots of qualifications when you're talking about this kind of thing, but in Western tonal music, quite a lot of non-Western tonal music also, you get this idea of tensions and resolutions. This is a clip from Bach, from J.S. Bach, from his great B minor mass, which is one of the greatest pieces he ever wrote. And right at the heart of the B minor mass, in the Creed movement, we get the Crucifixus movement, which is basically the Latin words say, "He was crucified also for us under Pontius Pilate, suffered and was buried." And what you're going to hear in this piece is you're going to hear a thing called a ground bass, which is basically a bass line that repeats itself, and it's dropping and dropping and dropping. And you get a sense of descending somehow into the grave in this piece of music. It's very powerful. It's got a choir. I'm just going to play the last minute or so of it, of the crucifixion movement. Can you hear it? Can you hear it loudly enough? There were lots of tiny tensions and resolutions going on all the way through that, in fact. But the one I'm thinking of here is the way it ended. And it actually modulated. It went from the minor key into what sometimes is called the relative major. It did a strange key change right at the end. And it leaves you with a sense that you can't stop here. Musically, it leaves you with a sense that you can't stop here, because in terms of the kind of musical language, particularly in Bach's day, you just couldn't do that. You couldn't, at the end of a long piece in one key, change key right at the end and then just stop. It's saying, come on, we've got to move on from this. There's got to be more. And the reason we've put this key change in is because we are moving on. And in fact, that's exactly what Bach does. At the end of the piece on the crucifixion, he moves, segues straight into this movement. I tried to stop it exactly on a beat. We can't listen to too much music. There isn't time. But so that is the resurrection. He rose on the third day. So musically, we have to move on into something. And what Bach is doing is linking the musical logic with something which to him was deeply theological, which is that you can't separate the crucifixion from the resurrection. And he has them. The B minor mass is a bit like an onion in a way. It's got lots of layers. And this is right at the heart. It is right at the epicenter of the whole piece, which takes about 2 hours to perform. It's a huge, it's a monumental piece. Right at the heart of it is the crucifixion and the resurrection. And musically, Bach is reinforcing a theological point, fundamental to him, that you can't separate the two. You can't put any kind of wedge in between the crucifixion and the resurrection, which is fascinating that he was linking theology and music like that. There's a guy called Jeremy Begbie who is used to teach at Ridley College in Cambridge, who's one of the people who's written most about music and theology, and there aren't that many actually. It's an area which is ripe for exploration. He talks a lot about music and time and theology. And he talks about music being something where, by listening to music, we have to learn to be patient and wait. We have to wait for musical resolutions, because music is all about waiting. Music is goal-orientated. It's going somewhere. And to find out where it's going, we have to invest some of our time. And that can be anything from 1 or 2 minutes, if it's a modern track, to 4 hours if it's a Wagner opera. You know, you have to be seriously investing time in a piece of music. And Begbie talks about this helping us to understand a bit more about patience as it's expressed in the Bible. And patience is a big theme in the Bible. The art of writing music is actually pacing resolutions carefully. You have to defer final resolution, but you have to keep the hope alive. If you don't do that, if you have too many kind of tensions and unresolved areas in your music, people will just get bored or give up on your music. But if you resolve things too easily, then people will get equally bored because it will all seem too easy for them. So the art of writing good music is in the way that they can defer resolutions and somehow sense when they need to resolve something. Music is also being compared to the idea of the Old Testament. We're thinking globally here, in big, big epic terms. The Old Testament being some kind of huge tension. And the New Testament, this is obviously from a Christian perspective, representing a resolution. Resolving all the ideas and the things that have been set up in the Old Testament. But there are, of course, further tensions that we then find in the New Testament itself. For example, in Romans 8, we read that it says, "We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption, the redemption of our bodies." And so it goes on. So this is a description of a kind of meantime between promise, the promise that we've received as Christians, and the final fulfillment that we haven't received yet. And that's where music always is. Music is somehow always moving between tensions and resolutions. Music isn't some kind of bland, amorphous nothingness. It's actually moving between tensions and resolutions. And at the same time, when we travel through all those tensions and resolutions, it's inviting us to discover a kind of patience, which perhaps might deepen us. It might deepen us. And you can take this idea further, because music, in fact, operates on a kind of multi-level way. Small motifs and phrases and groups of phrases are all piled up on top of each other. And resolution on a lower level increases tension on a higher level. And that gives us an even stronger reaching out for resolution. And this is the way in which music persuades us to keep listening to it. Now, that's a lot of talking. I'm just going to try and illustrate that with a piece of music. This was a piece which it's one of my things that I wrote for a natural history series about birds migrating called Earth Flight. And you have to imagine snow geese migrating from Louisiana north across the whole American continent, North American continent, over the snow as they get to Alaska and so on, or Canada. And we've got a two-bar thing which resolves every two bars, a rhythmic pattern, which is this. One, two, three, two, two, three. One, two, three, two, two, three. One, so that's it. It's a very short phrase. Just keep cycling. There's the beginning. There's the beginning. Now I can put a kind of twangy noise, which is called a wire rhythm, if you want to know, with that, which has a slightly longer trajectory. And the combination of the two immediately makes the first thing that you heard more interesting, because they're not resolving in the same way. Here we go. Now I can put a voice with it, which has a much longer phrase, probably an eight-bar phrase. Either four or eight bars. And I should know, but anyway. And remember, what's happening is that the resolutions on the lower level, every two bars, are increasing the tension on the higher level. If you listen to the voice on its own, it wouldn't sound particularly interesting, or it wouldn't give you much idea of tension. Here it is on its own. Quite atmospheric, quite nicely sung, but when you combine it with the other elements, much more interesting. And then when you bring in an orchestra as well, which luckily I can, the BBC Welsh, known as the Doctor Who Orchestra. are. So what's happening there is that the... Oh, thank you. The resolutions occurring at the lower levels are somehow motivating those long phrases over the top of them and giving rise to this reaching out for further resolution. And if they were heard on their own, that wouldn't happen. But because it's multi-leveled and the resolutions aren't all happening at the same time, if you arrange your music so that all your layers of resolution happen simultaneously, you can do that once or twice. When you hear that, it feels like the end of a section, maybe the end of a chapter in your music. But if you do it all the time, it starts to become very boring and it doesn't make sense. It's as though each chapter only lasts one word or something like that. It doesn't actually become coherent. Now, that multi-leveled way in which music works has been compared by Jeremy Begbie, actually, to the way in which the Bible works. So in the Old Testament, you know, if we look at the Pentateuch or the law, we get themes like resolutions or tensions and resolutions, like the fall and the call of Abraham, slavery in Egypt and then the Exodus, the experience of the wilderness followed by going into the land, these tensions and resolutions. And that all takes place in the law, but of course similar things happen in the histories in the Old Testament and in the wisdom books and in the prophets. The thing that overarches that, of course, is that it's all overarched by the great promises of the Old Testament, which slowly come to fruition. And then you have the New Testament, which can be divided up into Jesus' birth, perhaps. You can go into smaller elements, but if we start at the level of Jesus' birth, Jesus' ministry, his crucifixion, his resurrection or his passion, and then the early church, those are elements which are perhaps correspond to big phrases or in a piece of music like we just heard there. But a larger phrase would be that it all comes under the New Testament. But then the biggest phrase of all, the overarching phrase, would be that it comes under God's grand plan. If you want to explore any of this further, do look at what Jeremy Begbie has written. There's a book he's written called Music Theology in Time, which is worth dipping into. The first few chapters can be quite hard work, so I would start in something like chapter 3. Music and emotion is another area which is a huge, huge area. This theme is sad, this theme is happy. And we commonly describe music, don't we, with adjectives that would really refer to basic human emotions. And sometimes music is called the language of emotion. I've often heard that. But there's a big but here, because when you start reading about it, when you start reading the people who've really researched it and thought a lot about it, you find that there's no agreement at all about how music and emotion works. For example, the relationship between music and emotions is one of the most hotly debated themes in the literature of music theory. Some believe that the expression of emotion is the most important form of musical meaning. Others, that music is incapable of expressing emotions. I don't know what they mean by that, actually, but there we are. In the introduction to A Philosophy of Music, the Oxford Philosophy of Music, we read, "Today there is increasing agreement that music is able to express emotions. At any rate, very basic emotions such as happiness or fear or hope. But there are loads of answers as to how music does that in the literature." The only thing that they seem to agree on is that since music is not a representational art form, it can't imitate, this is coming back to what I was saying at the beginning really, it can't generally imitate or represent emotions, something else is actually taking place, and we experience the emotional qualities of the music directly without having to make a detour via representation. So we don't hear a representation of happiness or of a happy person, we hear happy music, or we hear music that sounds happy. If you can get your heads around that on a Saturday morning, you're doing very well. Lots of examples of music and emotions, but I think I better move on because we're a little bit short of time. The basic question, though, remains unanswered, I think, in all of the literature about music and emotion. How does it happen? There isn't any real final answer. Come back to what Martin Luther said, though. Martin Luther, as I said a bit earlier, said, "In music, we may taste with wonder, though never comprehend, the wisdom of God." Actually, I didn't say that. I said something else that Martin Luther said. But Martin Luther also said, "In music, we may taste with wonder, though never comprehend, the wisdom of God." And I just think that music might enable us to relate to a God we can't see directly, yet who experiences and expresses emotion. I'll say that again. It could be that music can help us relate or relate better to a God that we can't see, but a God who himself experiences and expresses emotion. Because you can't see music either. It doesn't tell you in so many words what it's about, but it moves you emotionally. And I think what is true is that music reaches deep into our inner world, and God can perhaps use music to help us see something afresh about God, or perhaps understand ourselves better. And of course, those two things are intimately related: understanding ourselves better, self-awareness, and knowing God better. And perhaps music can, by reaching deep into our inner world, music can actually help that process. Stravinsky, I was amazed to find this quote from Stravinsky. He said, "Music praises God. Music is well or better able to praise God than the building of the church or all its decorations. It is the church's greatest ornament." Yes. As a composer, I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think churches, you know, should give composers the budgets that they feel they have to put into repairing a spire. But again, you can't have a spire falling on people. It's true. We're coming quite close to the end. There is a big section which, if there'd been time, ironically, I was going to talk briefly about music, time and eternity. But there isn't time. Next year, somebody said. As somebody who specializes in writing music to picture, and that's what I've spent a lot of time doing and thinking about, I soon discovered that there is this amazing synergy between music and moving image. And that's something that I find endlessly fascinating, because directors also learn, along with their composers, that music has this amazing way of seeming to warp time. They can show you a three-minute sequence that is mute with no sound at all, and it can seem a bit kind of tedious, and they're thinking, this is too long. As soon as music is put with it, they're thinking, this is too short, because it seems to go past just like that. Music has a way of warping the sense of time passing when you put it with moving images. That's something that I'm doing a bit of postgrad research into, although it's so abstract, I can tell you. I think one of the reasons that music has this warping effect of the sense of time passing when it's put with images is because music can bring the three temporal poles together, by which I mean past, present and future. Because the very nature of music is that what we're hearing in the present only makes sense to us because we're also still hearing and remembering what we've just heard, which is now in the past. And what we're hearing in the present, which is still living with what we heard in the past, has to be anticipating what we're going to hear in the future. Otherwise, the music wouldn't make sense. If the music constantly kind of pulled the rug from under your feet, then you wouldn't keep listening to it. But with music, there's a use, maybe above all, of all things, the use of repetition. And music operates in the field of endless repetition. It's kind of wired into the DNA of music that it brings past, present and future together very much through repetition, also to do with tension and resolution that I was talking about. We've got to finish, really. we've got to finish at this point, but I think music can bring past, present and future together, and that can help us, if we're Christians, better appreciate that amongst all the things that the risen Jesus healed is time. Jesus healed the corrupting effects of time. We are in a meantime, and we've yet to finally experience that. But it's fascinating, isn't it, that the language of Revelation, the new heaven and the new earth, involves so much music and so much praise and singing. I don't see music as a way of escaping time. Sometimes people talk about music as being timeless. I don't see it as being that, but I see music as being a thing that helps us live more confidently in time, or if you like, more peaceably with time, in the light of eternity. Amen. Exactly. I think we probably should finish here. There are one of the things that I've been working on over the years, as well as my media music, is a filmic treatment of the Psalms. And there are, if it's of any interest to you at all, there are some of those CDs available under the little tent to my left, diagonally to my left. But I think, does anybody have any questions? We've got just a few minutes, and crazy, isn't it? We could speak for the rest of the same amount of time. What was your question, sir?
Right, I mean, it's fascinating. Thank you very much. But I think it was missing for me how theology and music might address music as sin, right, the dark side. Can music ever be bad? Because often we treat music as if it's the one thing in the whole world that escaped the fall.
Yes.
I think I'm thinking here, everything from the earworm that goes around your head.
Yes.
To young people who can sort of, I remember a story years ago in headbanging music. I'm actually kidding myself. It's getting really kind of music. And I'm thinking, for example, the way music is used to torture in places that the Americans have and the British have.
A very good question. This gentleman was saying, what about the darker side of music, music in a sinful context? What about that? And people often describe music as somehow being immune to sinfulness or bad things. And I think it's true. It's not immune to that. And I think the same things that are there in music which can help us glimpse God or draw nearer to God can be distorted and warped and used in, if you like, counterfeit ways to do the opposite. But I think it's probably the same features in music. And good old C.S. Lewis often talks about Satan taking something which is good and marring it or distorting it and turning it into something which is going to corrupt. And I think music can also do that. Thank you. These are going to be superficial answers, I'm sure. One more question, maybe one or two more. There were loads of hands that went up a moment ago. On the chair.
In terms of stress and resolution and past, present and future, where would you put jazz in this voting? Is it above classical music? Is it a finer art?
Where does jazz fit into... I think many of these categories apply equally to jazz. And I think it depends on what kind of jazz you're talking about, because obviously jazz, there's a spectrum, just as there is in so-called art music or classical music. And at some ends of jazz, experimental forms of jazz, it can sound to some people very atonal. And some people would find somebody who likes what you might call trad jazz or Dixieland or something commonly would say they can't stand modern jazz. And I think it's because they just can't latch on to anything. But the people who like listening to a lot of modern jazz, because their ear is attuned to that, will often say, no, I can sense where the tensions and resolutions are. I can sense where the repetition is. That's not true of all modern jazz, obviously, because some modern jazz is very experimental. But I think, in principle, this applies equally to jazz as it does to any other kind of music. Thank you. Do we need to stop? We probably do, don't we? I will be over with the CDs over there, so if you don't want to buy a CD but you want to talk to me, that's absolutely fine. Thank you very much.